for Friday, the 6th of April. We have one very brief work session to go into here initially, and then we'll open public hearings on the two bills that are up today, 2843 and 3515, together. So I'll now open a work session on House Bill 3370.
Mr. Chair, I move that House Bill 3370 be passed out of the committee without recommendation, and that the bill be moved to the House Human Services and Women's Welfare Committee.
Representative Barker moves that House Bill 3370 be passed out of the committee without recommendation, that the bill be moved to the House Human Services and Women's Wellness Committee. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative.
I want to support it.
It's a good bill. I was persuaded by the chair of the other committee that related more directly to her subject matter. And
I appreciate the money that I was received last session for the Deschutes County Drug Court, and I want to go on records. I support this bill.
Very good. Appreciate that, Representative. Any further discussion?
That's the reason it's going, Mr. Chair.
It is that the chair of the Representative Tomei, who chairs the House Human Services and Women's Wellness Committee, was persuaded that it related more directly to her subject matter, and because it related to health issues that she wanted to work on, and prevailed on the Speaker's office to move it to their committee. We have, committee members, 283 bills pending in our committee. It's not as though we have a lack, a dearth of bills.
Mr. Chair, this is relating to the criminal justice
commission. Yeah. It was it provides for therapies, which she has taken a particular interest in. Wanted to work in that committee. So that was the reason why the request was made.
Well, I would just make comment that I really think it fits this committee far better than her committee, and that the entire issue of drug courts, was all of that was in this committee, and this is where the end of this thing goes. But, you know, I'm not going to object to it, but if, you know, she has a burning desire, that's fine, I guess. You
know. Mr. Chair, I think that the money was worked in this committee last year, wasn't it? The funding and
I think the perspective presented to me was that the use of this flow of revenue from liquor sales in order to deal with these issues is something that there had been particular interest in that committee and working on, and because we had, as I say, we have so much work to do in our committee and so many bills, and somebody who was campaigning to get one of ours over to theirs seemed like a reasonable thing to do.
One question, Mr. Chair, do you know if there's been any discussion regarding the relating clause and there'd be any basic changes to the bill?
Nothing's been described to me. It was simply a desire to work with the bill in that committee, and given the amount of work that we have in our committee, it seemed reasonable that somebody who wanted to take this on and work with it, I didn't realize that the bill had special interest for people in our committee.
Mr. Chair, I mean, concern on Section 2 of the bill, all monies deposited in the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission account may used by the commission only for the establishment, operation, and maintenance of drug court programs and fund drug, alcohol, and mental treatment. That's a pretty big statement to send over to Health Committee on Oregon Criminal Justice account dollars.
Committee, I hear what the committee is saying, and I'm going to ask Representative Barker to withdraw his motion so we can get some further clarification on this. I didn't realize it would be sensitive to members of the committee, and I want to make sure we have fuller answers for them before we take this action.
And Mr. Chair, I withdraw my motion.
Thank you very much, Representative. I'll close the work session on House Bill 3370. I will now open a public hearing on the two other bills that are on our agenda this morning, which are House Bills 2843 and 3515. and we're going to open them together because there is a connection between the subject matter of these two bills. So I now open a public hearing on House Bill 2843 and 3515. And I'd like Council Stanford to give us an introduction for both bills.
Thank you, Chair McPherson and members of the committee. House Bill 2843 I'll deal with first. It rises out of a bipartisan coalition from the House and Senate, and to address problems related to pornography and children, the luring of minors for sexual conduct and activity. Its primary purpose lies in the creation of two new crimes: furnishing sexually explicit material to a child, which is a Class A misdemeanor, and luring a minor, which is a Class C felony. I've written the elements for the basic elements for furnishing up on the board up here, which I'm not sure if everybody can read, but furnishing sexually explicit material to a child consists of the following elements. First of all, that the defendant intentionally furnishes a child or intentionally permits a child to view, and a child is defined as under 13, so 12 or under. Sexually explicit material, and sexually explicit that the defendant knows is sexually explicit material. And sexually explicit material has a definition under 2843. It includes visual images of masturbation or sexual intercourse, genital-to-genital, oral-to-genital, anal-to-genital, or oral-to-oral contact, or the penetration of the vagina or rectum by an object. There are specific affirmative defenses set forth in 2843. Those include affirmative defenses for museum, school, or library employees acting in the scope of employment. If the materials are for sexual education or art education or for treatment, and they're furnished by a parent, a guardian, an educator, or a treatment provider, a third affirmative defense, if the sexually explicit material is an incidental part of a non-offending whole and it serves some purpose other than titillation. Four, if the defendant had reasonable cause to believe that the victim was not a child. Or five, if the defendant was less than 3 years older than the victim. It is not an affirmative defense if the victim is actually a law enforcement officer that's posing as a child. That's the crime of furnishing. It's a Class A misdemeanor. The second crime is luring of a minor, and that's an important distinction. A minor is defined as under 18, no longer a child. The crime of luring a minor consists of the following elements. First of all, the defendant furnishes to or uses with a minor. Secondly, a visual representation or a verbal description or a narrative account of sexual conduct, and the purpose was sexual gratification or to arouse or satisfy the sexual desires of the defendant or to induce the minor to engage in sexual conduct. The affirmative defenses for the crime of luring, which is a Class C felony, are similar to those for the crime of furnishing, other than like the scope of employment defense. The definition of sexual conduct is the same, essentially, as for what sexually explicit material is, except that the conduct also includes touching of the genitals, the pubic regions, the buttocks, or the female breast. House Bill 2843 also amends the existing crime of sending sexually explicit material to a minor in a number of different ways, one of the most significant of which is it specifically includes electronic transmissions. And then there's a lot of other sort of housekeeping and cleanup matters that House Bill 2843 entails, which I won't go into at this time. None of the crimes entail sex offender registration requirements presently. And I'll note on House Bill 2843, there is a dash one amendment that literally arose out of a catch that Legislative Council's office made this morning, and they were able to get that amendment done and complete within about an hour's time. And it's a technical fix, is all I'll say about it. That's House Bill 2843. Should I move to 3515?
Please.
House Bill 3515, then, I'll summarize now. It arises out of the Aloha High School public hearing on preventing Internet predators that this committee conducted earlier. What it does, its main focus, then, is it also creates two new crimes: online sexual corruption of a child in the second and first degrees. Let me flip the flip chart here. I'll describe what House Bill 3515 does in its present form, and then note for the record that there was a work group that formed that met to talk about amendments, and so the dash one amendments, I'd say, are the more significant ones. But nonetheless, in its present form, here's what House Bill 3515 does. It creates two new crimes: online sexual corruption of a child in the second degree and then in the first degree. And the second degree involves the following elements: a defendant who is older than 21, a victim who is under 16, the defendant uses an online communication for the purposes of sexual arousal, and either to solicit a child, which is the under 16, to engage in sexual contact or sexually explicit conduct, and those terms are defined in Oregon law, or to subject a child to an explicit verbal description or narrative account of sexual conduct or sexually explicit conduct. There is no defense if the child is actually a law enforcement officer or someone working at the direction of a law enforcement officer. That's online sexual corruption of a child in the second degree in its present form. Online sexual corruption of a child in the first degree involves that same offense, so second degree online sexual corruption, plus either offering or agreeing to physically meet with a child or taking a step towards physically meeting with the child. And both first and second degree online sexual corruption are registrable sex offenses. Now, that's its present form. Again, there was a work group that met to talk about amendments to 3515, and the work group consensus were the following changes. First of all, that no longer is there the same age, defendant being older than 21, Vic under 16. Under the new version, the defendant must be 18 or older. The victim need only be under 18. However, there's an affirmative defense if the age difference between the victim and the defendant is less than 3 years. That's a provision that's consistent with other provisions of Oregon law. Also, the most significant change is that in the Dash 1 version, the crime of online sexual corruption of a child in the second degree no longer is satisfied by words alone. The provision that says subjecting a child to explicit verbal description made a number of people uncomfortable, that's merely words, that what you should require is an actual solicitation. So that language is removed from the Dash 1 amendment in House Bill 3515, online sexual corruption in the second degree. And then the online sexual corruption in the first degree is that there's a solicitation, so you have second degree corruption, plus the person takes a substantial step towards physically meeting with or encountering the child. So that's now the distinction between second degree and first degree online sexual corruption. Online sexual corruption in the second degree is a C felony. Online sexual corruption in the first degree is a B felony. And again, the same, there's no defense if the minor is actually a law enforcement officer or someone working at the direction of a law enforcement officer. That still applies. That is the Dash 1 amendment that I've described. The Dash 2 amendment is the same as the Dash 1 amendment, except for one major distinction. There's no sex offender registration requirement under the Dash 2 amendment. And there's also a Dash 3 amendment to 3515, and what that amendment does is it essentially takes 2843, which I previously described, and incorporates it into House Bill 3515 into one.
Thank you, counsel.
We don't have the dash.
We don't have.
Committee members, you'll...
I'm sorry, I didn't catch that. What does the Dash 3 amendment do that we don't have?
My understanding, Representative Cameron, is that the Dash 3 amendment incorporates all of 2843 into 3515.
It combines
the two into one bill.
And committee, I would, because of the complexity of these issues and the overlap, it's not my intention that we're going to move anything today. So in terms of where the amendments, what elements are covered by different amendments, it's not critical that you understand just how those pieces work rather than to absorb sort of the broader policy questions that are presented by both bills together so we can then figure out what happens to those bills.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Wasn't
it? I have a couple of questions. One is who's the work group? I wasn't aware. You know, like when we had our hearing in Beaverton, I didn't know that there was a work group working on this. I have two bills that I think should be included in this discussion, and I didn't know anything about them. I know that they're in judiciary to be heard is one bill I would suggest that we look at in relationship to this is. House Bill 3233, and I have a bill that addresses forfeiture this, and I didn't know that who was on the group, or could we know who's on the group?
House Bill 3233, and what was the other bill?
I'll have to get you the number. It's
okay.
It's a forfeiture of assets of someone that's involved in internet or solicitation.
Okay. Well, by all means, if there are other bills that you think arise out of the same subject matter, you should alert me to the interest
Very
in
good.
Those bills.
Okay. I was just lobbied on 3233, but that's the sex offender treatment. And since the fines are so high in these two bills, I thought it would adequately fund. I think they're only looking for $50,000 to set up this board.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, we have before us 2843 and 3515, so I think we should focus on those bills today. And if there are other issues that ought to be coming in by amendment, we can certainly consider those down the road. But those are we ought to be focusing ourselves on these bills now. Committee, we had, of course, a broad introduction to the Internet Predator subject matter on our roadshow hearing in Aloha. And we will, and this is really the second of these bills. 3515 is the bill form of that's responsive to that issue and some concern and the issues that arose out of that hearing. And the work group that's been working with counsel for the committee was an outgrowth of the input that we got in the committee at that time.
Mr. Chair, and I had the same question as to if you could tell us the members or the participants in the work group so that we could be aware of that makeup.
Well, it was stakeholders who have been working with council. It's not a work group of the committee.
What do we have an idea of the stakeholders that are involved?
Well, I think what we need to do, committee, is to get the input from people who are in the room today, and then we can discuss how we proceed from there.
Yeah.
So let's.
So that's not available.
Well, let's right now. We're in public hearing. We got to hear from the public about the bills that have been given notice of, which has been given today, and then we can discuss process after we've gotten the input from the public that's been invited to present to us. We now have since we have the introduction that we got in the committee in our roadshow hearing on 3515, we're going to focus on broad introduction to House Bill 2843, and I'd like to invite now Representative Andy Olson and Senator Kate Brown, who are chief sponsors of that bill.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chair. Committee members, for the record, State Senator Kate Brown represents Senate District 21, a little bit of Northeast Portland, a lot of bit of Southeast Portland, and the city of Milwaukee. The good Representative Olson and I were just discussing how this work group got created. We are not an official Judiciary Committee work group. We are just two people who ended up coming to the same place through very different paths. As many of you know, I chair the Oregon Law Commission's Juvenile Law Task Force. Our job is to rewrite the juvenile code in a way that non-practitioners can understand it. During one of my meetings last year, we heard testimony from a doctor regarding the harmful effects of pornography. I believe that doctor is here in the room today. And then as a result of that, I asked Bill Taylor, who participates in our work group, to get a legislative draft going to address the issues raised by a court case. Our objective here is to prevent child sexual abuse and predatory child sexual exploitation. The problem is that ORS 167065 was held unconstitutional by prior court rulings. So our goal is to craft a statute that is constitutional. Representative Olson and I came together to do that. We had a number of partners, including folks from the DA's office, Department of Justice, the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers, and the ACLU. And we spent many months grappling over the details of House Bill. It was LC 87 and became House Bill 2843. And at that, I'd like to turn it over to my colleague, Representative Randy Olson. Randy Olson. Andy Olson. Sorry. He's also Randy.
It's okay, Kathy.
Hi, my name is Randy Olson, and I'm a representative from Albany. But anyways, Mr. Speaker, I sense that possibly that you could use some donuts starting out this morning. I mean, I heard recently, even though you might be in a donut shop, that doesn't make you a cop. So bring that perspective to you.
On the subject of donuts, Representative, I will defer to you any day of the week.
Well, you have two other members on here that I'm sure know how to eat those things. Anyways, thanks. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of this committee for allowing us to hear this and to move forward with 2843. And as Senator Brown shared, it was interesting how we met together, but I just want to give you a little bit of history how we did move forward, and I won't spend a great deal of time on that because I do have a number of people that I've asked, invited here to share with you this morning to give you a perspective of the harm at an early age for children, to share also the involvement and the harm that investigators see as a result of this issue, to see, as Senator Brown mentioned, doctors, a counselor's perspective regarding it, as well as prosecution. And then also someone that deals with victims as well afterwards as a result of it. So you're going to get a good sweeping view of exactly what we're after. But Deputy Todd Hargrove, he's an investigator with the Linn County Sheriff's Office. About a year and a half ago, he approached me and asked me if there was something that we could do regarding this issue. And from that point forward then, I sat down and talked with Bill Taylor, and the work group began at that point. And just as Senator Brown has mentioned, too, of all those that participate in it, there was a lot of people. I'm telling you. And we met several different times during the interim because our goal was to create some policy that would protect children and also at the same time provide a good tool for law enforcement out there regarding this. There was, I have handed this around to you, but this was actually on the front cover. You have it from the Gazette Times out of Corvallis, but also the Democrat Herald had it. And this was on the front page of the Sunday paper that's shared through the whole Mid-Valley. And it was about iPorn. Actually, what it is what's happening right now on the iPods and the porn that's downloaded and also sent over. But it was extremely hardcore stuff that's going on. And the conversation, Dr. David Byrd is a clinical psychologist and also a marriage family therapy counselor over in Corvallis, wasn't able to attend here. But he has a lot of his comments in the story. And I'd like to just refer that to you. You know, basically at this point right now, this gives you an example of how much work we did during the whole interim time period and where we wanted to go with this thing. So you have, I think, the council shared with you during Stanford did a good job going through just the main points of 2843. At this point right now, I'm just going to move through the group that I've asked to share with you and give you some evidence why this is a good bill.
That sounds fine to me, Representative.
Mr. Chair, one more comment, if I may. On page 2 of the bill, as Council Stanford so clearly articulated in terms of affirmative defenses, it refers to treatment providers, and I wanted to clarify for the record that this would not affect the ability of family planning clinic providers and health educators to provide information to their clients. So, and I also wanted to say, Council Stanford, I think you missed your calling. You should have been a law school professor. You did a very nice job this morning.
Thank you.
Before we let the chief sponsors go, are there any questions for them? Thank you, Senator Brown.
Thank you.
Representative Olson.
Mr. Chair, if I could ask if change the dynamics of that a little bit and ask for Jason Carlisle and Michael Slosick.
Very good.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. My name is Jason Carlisle. I'm the district attorney in Linn County. I've been prosecuting criminal cases since 1980, and I've been the district attorney in Linn County since 1988. And that experience is really the reason that I'm here today. During the course of my more than 20 years as a prosecutor, I have had police officers and young deputy DAs come to me time after time and say, Jason, isn't there something we can do about what we just found out in this particular home that we went into? The fact patterns that concern me are, it generally arises as a byproduct of an investigation into something else. Oftentimes it's a drug-related investigation, and during that investigation, the police officers get into the home and they find that small children are being shown extremely graphic pictures of all kinds of sex acts. I don't even use the word pornography anymore, because I don't think it adequately describes the kinds of visual depictions that we're talking about. We're not talking about some kind of alluring, fuzzy, focused picture here. We're talking about graphic pictures of sex acts. And when you, the deputy DAs and police officers that would come to me, they'd say, Jason, isn't there something we can do about that? That hurts these little kids. It's got to screw up their brain when they see this stuff. I've been telling them from about 20 years, no, we don't have a tool to deal with this until we get to House Bill 2843. That plugs a big hole in the criminal code that gives us a tool to deal with these issues. I was a part of the work group. I do know that the Oregon District Attorneys Association has discussed this bill, and the legislative committee is supportive of the bill. I want you to know I'm supportive of it, because it hurts kids, and we've got a big hole in our criminal code right now that we haven't been able to fill for many, many years. And that's my point.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Carlisle. Let's hear from Mr. Slauson then. Go ahead.
Good morning, Chair McPherson, members of the committee. I am Michael Slauson. I am with the Oregon Department of Justice. I'm Assistant Attorney General in the Organized Crime Section, and I'm the prosecutor for the Internet Crimes Against Children Task Force. I had the privilege of testifying before this committee back on March 19th about solicitation of minors over the Internet to commit sexual acts, and here today I'm to testify both on 2843 and 3515. And what I'd like to do is just talk with the committee briefly about how these bills work together and how they work with current law. What 2843 does is it gets at conduct pretty early on in the stage of grooming, specifically looking at the sections dealing with luring. It's really the first process used by those who would offend children to lower their inhibitions to engage in sexual conduct at some later date. So what that does then is it gets at the most early conduct, the first point of attack, if you will. What 3515 does is come in at sort of a later date. Okay, you've already sort of lowered the inhibitions of the kids, and now what you're going to do is actually solicit them for sex. Then in Oregon law, where we have now, we don't cover that. We don't cover that kind of conduct directly. What we have now is even a step one more removed from that, which is an attempted crime. And then after that, we would, of course, have the completed crime. So both of what these bills do is they cover conduct that is a gap in our current law. And they address the particular harm that's associated with that type of conduct. As I mentioned, it's not currently covered. With House Bill 3515, I will say that the Department of Justice supports that concept generally, as I mentioned the other day before this committee. And I'd also like to note that I've submitted written testimony on both of the bills, and I'm happy to answer any questions that the committee might have about either one of them.
Are there any questions for Mr. Slauson? Representative Wisnett.
Thank you very much, and I would probably speak for everyone confidently that they're supporting this. Your statement that you gave us in writing says there's no physical impact on Department of Justice. Obviously, there's going to be a DOC impact. Has that been looked at or studied?
Chair McPherson, Representative Wisnat, I don't have an answer to that question. Yeah, there would be, but it's not something that I've looked into. I can get back to the committee if that'd be helpful.
Do we have that?
We don't have any impact analysis on, essentially it's a question of prison beds. Anytime that you create a new felony, that has an impact on the prison population. Any other questions for Mr. Slauson? Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thanks. Representative Olson, did you, other than your list, we should proceed down the list you gave me earlier in the order that you had requested?
Sure. Mr. Chair, actually, if you could request Lonnie Bevel, Judy Beretta, and Karen Shield, as I've done, kind of give a lot better view for you.
Three, Lonnie Bevel, Jody Beretta, and Karen Shield could come forward. I'll let you decide which one of you will go first, but please begin by identifying yourself for the record.
Thank you, Chair McPherson, members of the committee. My name is Jody Beretta. I represent the County District Attorney's Office. I'm here in support of House Bill 2843. I've been a prosecutor of child sex abuse crimes for the last 3.5 years. I was also a member of the committee that worked very hard to draft this bill. I'm here today to tell you that prosecutors desperately need this tool in order to hold predators accountable, in order to prevent children from being abused. A large portion of the cases that we get in every day involve both giving pornography to children and luring children through sexually explicit conversation, be it online, through text messaging, through emails. We've even had cases where these predators will leave notes for children outside their homes. This bill would encompass all that sort of behavior. We see people giving pornography to children in order to groom them for later sexual abuse. We also see it used as an instrument of the abuse itself. Oftentimes, especially in sexual abuse of very young children, you see these predators using the pornography to show the children what acts to do in order to teach them what they would like to perform on them. This is always incredibly harmful to those kids. We also see those children are best able to articulate what they see in the movies or what they see in the pornography better than the abuse that happens to themselves. If that's all we're left with, we don't have a crime currently under Oregon law. We have children who are being exposed to this, who are being forced to act out these things, and currently there's no accountability for the people who are doing it to them. In terms of luring the children, as I said before, they use all sorts of mechanisms to lure the children. They use it to groom. They use it to desensitize the kids. They use it sometimes just to stimulate the person themselves. They get some sort of sexual gratification in just presenting this conversation to children. We see this constantly. There's a huge gap in the law in terms of luring as it stands now. The only tool that prosecutors have is an attempt to commit some sort of sexual abuse. This is incredibly hard at a practical level as a trial attorney, incredibly hard to prove to a jury beyond a reasonable doubt that somebody is attempting to commit sex abuse merely by chatting online or engaging in sexually explicit conversation with them. As a practical matter, these crimes don't get charged because it is so difficult to prove. As it currently stands, we have to show a substantial step that somebody takes. We're forced to set up a meeting with a child, or we have to wait until actual abuse, hands-on abuse, is attempted in order to get these people held criminally accountable. This bill takes care of that. It would allow us to stop this abuse in the grooming stage, hold people accountable while they're grooming the children, while the harm is just starting to be done. We no longer have to wait until abuse physically occurs in order to catch these people and hold them accountable and protect these kids. I ask you to help give prosecutors the tool to hold these people accountable and to stop the abuse when it first starts and in the grooming process. Thank you.
Let's hear from the other members of this panel, and we'll open it up for questions.
Chairman McPherson and members of the committee, my name is Karen Sheeler, and I am the executive director of the ABC House in Albany, Oregon. And the ABC House is the Child Assessment Center that serves children from both Linn and Benton counties. And we are part of a network of 19 centers across the state providing services for children. ABC House has been in existence for 10 years now, and we have provided services to over 2,800 children. 80% of those children have been to our center for issues of child sex abuse. I'm here today because 2 years ago was the first encounter for me as a member of the MDT of wanting a large case about pornography exposure to children to be prosecuted, and that was my first experience of finding there is no way to do that, and that it is legal right now for parents to show pornography to their children, for anyone to do that. And the effect on children is long-lasting. We see children of all ages being exposed. Some of the most difficult situations in our building that we see are teens who have exposure to pornography. They don't know what to do with those issues and those visions in their memory, and they then move on to experiment with younger children. And some of the most difficult cases for us as people who provide services are when we have a young child in our center who is a victim with their parent, and the offender is the teenage brother or sister. We then have a family that is completely destroyed because there's a victim, an offender, and that offender is very often facing major 11 crimes. But it all started because of the exposure to pornography. And more than not, that family will never be reunited, and damage is permanent. That child who is the victim and has been raped by a sibling is then left to deal with that for the rest of their life. It does not mean that they cannot recover, and they often do, with the amount, the proper support from their family. But there's always a piece out there that is with them, for both them and the offender. In 2006, in our building, 16% of the alleged offenders of children were teens, and many, many of these teens were involved with pornography. Research says that children who are exposed to pornography under the age of 14 then have a greater risk of becoming involved in deviant sexual behavior, especially rape. 95% of the time, the offender is someone who is known to a child. That gives that offender an even more access to use the pornography that as a grooming tool. And several people have spoken about that. It's grooming is a process for offenders, and pornography is just one of those tools to help ease into that and lower their inhibitions, where children can then be a little more accessible to sexual acts. Young children are just not developmentally prepared to deal with the visions that they see. Not all children receive it in a negative way, however. Some are curious, some are sexually aroused, and then they go to experimenting at very young ages. And we have what we call groups of victims. We have the child who's been exposed to pornography, who then moves out into their small circle of friends and experiments. And then we have not just the child exposed to pornography, but we have 4 or 5 children amongst that one victim's group of friends and they have all been experimenting sexually, then we're dealing with five families who have issues, who have to seek counseling, who have to find ways to help their children deal with that new exposure that they are not ready to deal with. The internet use and exposure of pornography is in our building every week, almost every day, that it is so accessible. And we have young teens who are viewing pornography, who have been exposed. When they have adults showing them pornography, it's enticing and it's alluring to them. And then we have teens now, the iPod, all that. We have had multiple cases where we have students photographing nude pictures of each other and then shipping it across their cell phones. It gets on the internet and it takes on a life of its own. And then we have a person who may or may not have willingly participated in that, having no idea what the extent of what they did is going to come to. It just takes on a life of its own. And those are lifelong issues also that those children regret. So I ask you to seriously consider this. We have no tool to deal with it. We have so many victims, and they are not able to speak for themselves. They're not able to protect themselves from this. We have to do that. We have to step up and protect them. Thank you.
Thank you. Go ahead.
My name is Lonnie Bevel, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I simply want to share some thoughts from a counseling perspective. I'm trained as a marriage and family therapist, state of California, licensed in 91. Came up to Oregon in 93 as a pastor of counseling for a church in Albany, where I currently work. As families and as a society, we must balance our personal rights with protecting our kids. We recognize that we must protect children from addictive substances such as nicotine and alcohol, and I believe we currently have laws to do so. Pornography is also extremely addictive. Regarding our children's development, pornography is also harmful on both a psychological level as well as a relational level. Pornography acts as a psychological drug. All recreational drug use falls into three categories: stimulant, depressant, and hallucinogen. Pornography functions on all three levels. To quote Dr. Paul Simpson, an expert in the field, pornography is the one-size-fits-all wonder drug, and cybersex, or internet pornography, is the crack cocaine of the porn industry. Cybersex adds to the addictive nature of pornography through its accessibility, affordability, and anonymity. Patrick Carnes, a pioneer in the field of sexual addiction and compulsion, estimates the level of destructiveness caused by sexual compulsion to be comparable to the destructiveness caused by substance abuse. The field of sexual addiction and compulsion is simply 20-plus years behind the field of substance abuse regarding its findings. While pornographic fantasy does not always lead to sexual compulsion, it is a key factor in diverting healthy sexual development into a narcissistic and objectifying form of sexuality. Doug Weiss, in his Guide for Sex Addiction Recovery, states, "Many sexual compulsives were exposed to pornography at a young age, began to masturbate and or fantasize with it. Every time the compulsive ejaculated, he sent a rush of chemicals to his brain called endorphins and enkephalins. The brain, as an organ of the body, has no morality. It just knows that when it gets a rush of what I call brain cookies or chemicals, it feels good. The rush could be from heroin, skydiving, sex, or cocaine. But whatever has caused the rush, the brain as an organ could not have a moral dilemma on how it got this rush. After frequent ejaculation brought on by acting out, the sexual compulsive begins to develop neurological pathways in the brain while acting out sexually. The brain as an organ adjusts to getting its neurological needs met by the cycle of going into a fantasy state and 20 to 30 minutes later experiencing a rush of brain cookies through ejaculation," unquote. What Weiss describes as the brain adjusting to getting its neurological needs met is in essence the formation of psychological addiction. Recognizing that this vulnerability to developing a psychological addiction to pornography exists at all ages, we must underscore the extreme vulnerability and harmfulness that pornography creates, especially for children. As with underage drinking and smoking, minors engaged with pornographic fantasy have an increased vulnerability to psychological addiction as compared to adult populations. In addition, developmental milestones involving productivity, identity, relationship, and intimacy are impaired. Healthy mastery of these developmental milestones is necessary for maintaining one's self-image, work ethic, and intimate relationships. When damaged significantly, these underdeveloped dimensions result in depleting one's life, quality of life, and relationships. Clinically and pastorally, I have counseled many individuals who have had their lives devastated through sexual addiction. Pornography has been a consistent theme on their road from recreational sex to increased degrees of sexual excess and finally to full-blown sexual addiction. Pornography in their childhood and adolescent experience has often been the beginning point of their devastating journey. My assessment is that exposure of our children to sexual explicit material is outlined in House Bill 2843 is both psychologically and relationally damaging. Our children need every opportunity to develop health and wholeness in their lives. I urge you to protect our children.
Thank you, Pastor Bevel. Any questions, please? Presented by Michi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your testimony. I have a question about something that was raised by Ms. Is it Sheeler? Mm-hmm. But I think I'm going to ask it to Ms. Beretta because of your role as a prosecutor. You mentioned, Ms. Sheeler, the teenagers taking pictures of each other and sending them back and forth on their phones. And I wonder how that situation would be prosecuted under 2843 if they're both teenagers but they're more than 3 years apart.
Yes.
So for example, like 13 and 17 years old.
Thank you, Representative. Is it
Bonamici?
Bonamici. Okay. To answer your question, I actually think that scenario is already covered under a current statute, which would be using a child in a display of sexually explicit activity. That's something that we prosecute under that statute now. I don't necessarily think that that conduct would be encompassed in without some more facts kind of supporting how it would fall under this bill. I think that it's better encompassed under that crime that already exists.
Thank you.
Ms. Beretta, as a prosecutor, what problems do you foresee establishing proof when something is transmitted through cyberspace, as they say, and you can maybe be able to trace it back to a particular computer, but what elements of proof are there as to who it was who was doing the sending? I mean, when you have a person who's showing up, you know, they've groomed the child and they show up at the door, then you know who it is, but what are the issues of proof when you don't have somebody actually showing up at a location?
Sure. Thank you, Chair McPherson, for that question. To answer that, there are always proof problems. Right now, we prosecute crimes, child pornography crimes, where just somebody's in possession or duplicating, and we have the same issues of proof. The way we kind of combat that is we have computer forensic examiners, fantastic detectives in the state who are trained and who go through a process that's far more complicated than I generally understand with how to track back an actual IP address on someone's computer for the exact log-in time that the person was logged into the computer. All of this stuff is saved on the computer and can be downloaded and I'm afraid a detective is better able to answer this question because they're the ones who end up explaining it to my juries and explaining it to me in the end. But there actually are ways to get that information off the internet and off the computer to put a person logging in at a certain time. We then use detectives to find out who was at the home, who had access to the computer, who was password protected into the computer at that time. An interview of the suspects is often very helpful. Where were you? Can we corroborate that you were at work at the time? So we can actually place a body in the chair at the computer at the time something was disseminated. And so we have these proof issues in child pornography cases now, and we combat them often very successfully just using our detectives to do that.
Any further questions? Thank you very much. We'll move on to working off Representative Olson, the list you had proposed would be next Ed Glaspie, Todd Hargrove, and Craig Stolk.
And Mr. Chair, you could actually
if you could bring up Bill Carroll, too, as well, from the department. He might be able to answer some of your questions regarding the internet piece as well.
So we could pull an extra chair up there, perhaps, to have a fourth person at the witness table. Again, I'll let you gentlemen decide who will go in what order.
Okay. Chairman McPherson, members of the committee, my name is Craig Stoke. I'm a police detective with the city of Salem. I've been a police officer for the past 30 years and investigating child sexual assault for the past 23 years. To date, I've investigated well over 3,000 sexual assault cases involving children. I wanted to provide testimony in support of House Bill 2843, and I'm going to limit my views to my experience in regard to how I see pornography impact children during the course of investigations that I conduct. I find that investigations I involve myself in with children during sexual abuse show that there's a considerable regularity between the connection of the use of child pornography in regard to grooming children to set the stage for them to believe that sexual activity is permissible and an enjoyable type of activity to engage in with the adults that are attempting to engage in sexual activity with them. I find that also when I go out and contact offenders after the fact, that they ultimately oftentimes also admit that they use pornography for their personal gains, for trying to get the children interested in sexual activity, and that they also use these materials to stimulate themselves in the absence of victims, real-life victims, and that they continue to use the pornography for the purpose of showing to the children during the course of the sexual activities that they'll commit with them. And what I find when I'm looking into these cases is that this goes beyond the notion of someone having a Playboy or a Penthouse magazine laying around and someone happens to see it. There is a lot of thought that goes into the pornography that's being shown to children. It comes in a wide variety of forms, whether it's publications, magazines, Polaroid photos of other victims, internet images that other people can attest to, or even in the form of comic book sketches to encourage viewing by younger children. And the sexual activity is oftentimes very theme-related to the type of sexual activity that the older individual or the offender wants to engage in with the children. And just as an example, I wanted to show a couple ideas of what I've seen with offenders. And these are not necessarily people that you would view as half-wit individuals that people might want to stereotype offenders as being. The three examples I'm showing are all people that were professional people working here in Salem or retired business people. And this was a grandpa that was showing artistic sketches to his 12-year-old daughter, suggesting that she would look good in these images and that he would practice posing with her and go out and buy her lingerie to suggest that that she would look good like this, and as she gets older that this will be what she's like. And he would put his hand inside his pants and masturbate, and she's assuming that he's masturbating, but she can't see it. Under our current laws, that is not a crime. She did not visually watch him masturbate. She did not see his penis, but she's smart enough to know what's going on. Another case that I recently investigated was a 6-year-old girl who's an African-American living with a white individual, and her mother is African-American, and this individual has been vaginally raping and orally and anally sodomizing the 6-year-old girl for the last 2 years, and he would have her sit and watch the little sluts beg for it, and he would have her sit on the bed and watch a vignette, 5 or 6 minutes of the tape, and say, okay, let's act out that scene. And the girl described that in vivid detail, how she's watched that videotape for the last year and a half with him, and she knows all the scenes in the movie. As I said, she was part of a biracial relationship. His other films that he liked to watch with her was Chocolate Ass Candy. And there's a clear correlation that his sexual interests are very theme-related, and that's what he wants to interact with his victims with. And I see this in the course of my 23 years doing this. This has been repetitive, broken record-type behavior that you see over and over again. And for the past 23 years, as we have cases where children are being subjected to watching these materials and yet no hands-on sexual contact has taken place, where incapable of taking enforcement action on people that are trying to set the stage for this to take place. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Stoke. Next.
I guess I'll go ahead. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Todd Hargrove. I'm a detective with the Linn County Sheriff's Office. My primary responsibility is investigating child sex crimes. And I guess I just wanted to come here today and share with you some of the real-world examples of what I have seen or know of during our investigations at the Linn County Sheriff's Office, where pornography has played a role in exploiting children in sex crimes. One of the most recent cases that our detective division is handling is a case of a 7-year-old boy who, over the past several years, has been watching his mother engage in sexual activity with other men. And I'm not talking about videos, but live sexual acts that he's witnessed. And he's also had access to different types of pornography, magazines, videos, etc. This little boy has since gone on to begin reenacting what he has witnessed and victimizing his 3 younger siblings and 1 other cousin. And he's only 7 years old. This kid's going to have a lifetime of damaging effects because of what he's witnessed. Another case that I investigated was a child was being babysat, and the babysitter's older son, a teenage son, would take the boy who's being babysat to his bedroom and have him watch pornography with him. The first time, they simply watched the pornography. There was no touching involved. Subsequent times led to the older boy sodomizing the younger boy repeatedly. This wasn't reported until the victim. The victim is now almost 18 years old. He's had a problems with drug abuse and lots of delinquent type behavior. Of course, I can't sit here and tell you it's directly related to that, but my suspicions is they are. We could probably sit here all day and go over cases. Another case, a significant case that was handled by our office was a middle-aged man who made his apartment available to young boys in the neighborhood. He provided them with drugs, alcohol, cigarettes, and also made all sorts of different types of pornography available to them. The boys were able to come into his house and essentially do whatever they wanted to. This man was ultimately arrested for sexually abusing many of these victims, of these young boys. Another case that I investigated, which kind of kick-started me to call Representative Olson, was investigating a child sex abuse case, and it wasn't directly related to, but a boy that I interviewed said that his dad, while on visits during the weekend, would sit down with him and watch pornography. There was no abuse disclosed by the boy, but he described him sitting down watching pornographic videos with his dad, like we might watch Finding Nemo with our kids, which is absolutely inappropriate in my eyes. Another case that one of our detectives handled was a case of a 12 or 13-year-old boy taking pornographic magazines, the Playboy Hustler type, to school and showing them to the younger kids at school. This person has subsequently gone on to become a registered sex offender. Another case that I investigated came to my attention. A young deaf girl, she was about 12 years old. Her parents, she grew up in about the worst kind of lifestyle that possibly you could imagine. Her parents were drug addicted and basically gave her up to some friends. And these friends, over the years, would have her sit and watch pornographic videos with the adult male who was taking care of her. And he, raped her for a number of years. and her biological father was out of the picture. He was in prison for sexually abusing other minors down in California. So those are just some kind of real-world examples of what we as investigators see every day and how pornography really adversely affects our kids and the lifetime it affects, the effects it's going to have on them, not only them, but our criminal justice system as well. And if we can have some sort of tool to intercept that early on, I think it's going to work out really well. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hargrove. Next.
My name is Ed Gillespie. I'm a counselor at Restoration Ministries in Junction City, Oregon. I come from a little different side of this. I, at age 12, got introduced to pornography as a young boy, not knowing where that was going to take me, but through my early teens, become addicted and more addicted. And like any addiction, it only lasts so long, and you got to try something a little more potent. And so the progression for me went from bad to worse. And about the time I got married, I assumed when I got married that that would kind of end my addiction to pornography, but found I'd already become so much in a fantasy world, because what pornography really is, it's not a reality, it's a fantasy. And we men, specifically, are more visual, attracted by seeing something. And so when I saw those things, those images, they stuck in my mind. And so what I assumed was that that's what my wife would desire. And so, you know, when I tried some of the kinky things that I saw on porn with my wife, she didn't like it. And I'm going, you know, what's wrong with her? And so I tried to get her to watch porn so she could come up to speed of what a real woman wants, and found out that I was the one that was wrong. And guys, I'll tell you what, that thing almost destroyed my marriage. That led me, when my wife wouldn't respond to it, I decided, well, I'll find somebody who will. And so I went out and I found some that would. And my wife ended up leaving me. I had two twin daughters, 1.5 years old. And at that time, it was the most devastating thing in my life. That's what turned me around. And I got my wife back, my kids back, and I started a process of getting rid of porn out of my life. You know, I now deal, I've done this for 20 years, and I deal with men who are caught into the whole porn scene. You know, and the unfortunate victims, a lot of times, and I know a lot of this is for protection of children, and it's a true thing, but a lot of times the real victims of this are the wives of men who are addicted to pornography. Because what it says to a woman is, this is just a wrong way of dealing with life. A woman does not desire those things. To me, a woman became a sex object only. And guys, where I was headed, I realized I would be a Ted Bundy or something if I didn't turn this around, because it got worse and worse and worse. And so as I turned it around, you know, I now deal with all the couples that are broken marriages, and a good part of those come from porn. I had a gal one time in counseling with her. Her husband was so much into fantasy that the only way he could make love to her is on the headboard of the bed. He'd pin a centerfold of a magazine. He would look at that as he's making love to his wife. So porn is a powerful addiction. It took 30 years of my life. But when I finally turned it around, now the past 20 years, I helped men to escape from that, to give them a balance of what a real woman is and what the desires of a woman really is, not what it's shown on porn. Those ladies on porn are paid to do those things. That isn't what they really desire. And so I have a real interest in this, too, because I see this affect kids. You know, in my day, you had to go find porn. You had somebody to get it for you. And what it did to me in almost destroying my life, I can't imagine what the kids today face with the Internet, where you don't have to go looking for porn. It comes right to your room. And so I'm here to, I guess, as an example of what porn can do to you. I got free of it. I see thousands of men get free of it. I actually work full-time with men, helping them to recover from the effects of pornography. But it's a devastating force. It really is. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Glassby.
Next.
Representative McPherson, members of the committee. Do I need the microphone or...
You need to speak into the microphone to record all these proceedings so that anybody in the future could go back and hear your words of wisdom.
Okay, thank you for that. I also had an opportunity to address the committee on March 19th.
And you need to identify yourself for the record before you begin.
My name is Bill Carroll. I'm the Chief Investigator for the Criminal Justice Division of the Department of Justice. I'm also the Internet Crimes Against Children Task Force Commander since it was formed in July of 2004. And what I'd like to bring in support of this bill is that aggressive tactics by pornography marketers combined with increased speed and capacity of computers and Internet connections are partially to blame for the increase of unwanted sexual solicitations, pornography, and harassment. These are rarely reported to Internet service providers or authority, and kids and parents are generally unaware of places where they can report these solicitations. Specifically, what we use is the cyber tip line maintained by the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. Statistics show that 1 in 5 youths aged 10 to 17 who go online are solicited, and 1 in 4 are exposed to pornographic videos. What's even scarier is that 1 in 24 who go online receive an aggressive solicitation, a gift in the mail, or a phone call, which is a predecessor to meeting in real life. In a University of New Hampshire study on kids and porn, 1/3 of young Internet users were exposed to unwanted pornography in 2005, a number that rose 25% from a 1999-2000 study. That number reflects that pornography is extremely graphic. It includes images of people engaged in sexual activities and sexual deviance or violence. And I've heard some testimony here about pornography this morning, and I've been involved with this Internet Crimes Task Force for the last 3 years. And I want to say that whenever we talk about pornography, at least from the Internet side of this, I'm talking about visual depictions of violence, of adults raping children. I'm not talking about pornography of adults engaging in sexual activity with other adults, though I will say that that is offered on a number of occasions as a satisfactory thing for children to watch to show that it's okay. But more than that, what we see is a violent depiction of rape of children, showing children that it's okay to have sex with adults, that this is accepted activity. What we also see is a spike of children between age 10 and 12 using the Internet. And I want to point out that what we have is innocent children. Think about your own kids, and when they're growing up, they're so susceptible to the influence of adults, whether it's the parents, the neighbors, the teachers, whoever it is. And if you're like me, you probably saw at one point in your child's life they all of a sudden knew everything. But before that, they listened to the parents and they listened to the adults. And by showing them graphic depictions of why it's okay for an adult to engage in something with a child is a teaching and a grooming method. Investigators engaged in undercover capacity routinely receive images from individuals engaged in masturbation via webcam or pornographic images. These images, again, are individuals engaged in sexual activities and work as a method to break down inhibitions of the children that they believe that they are conversing with. When we take a persona, we're usually taking a persona of a 10 or 12-year-old child. And we start getting solicitations right away, asking for age, sex, and location, wanting phone numbers on how to make specific contact, make that personal contact. It is not unusual to all of a sudden just have a webcam start shooting video to you of somebody sitting there masturbating or sending pornographic images to you or starting to talk in graphically sexual language to you. I've seen this during my investigations and the training that I've had. Plus, I went ahead and I contacted a couple of other investigators that I wanted to just toss out the information to you. One investigator is Jim Cole, a special agent with the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency. He works in Portland. He reports that during his conversations online in an undercover capacity, 60 to 65% of those chats result in individuals sending him pornography, thinking that they're conversing with a child. Micah Persons, who is our investigator with the Internet Crimes Against Children Task Force here in Salem, works for the Criminal Justice Division. He recently went to an undercover chat training, and he's going to be training other individuals around the state in conducting effective online chats. In his undercover chat capacity, he reported to me that 100% of all the chats resulted in pornography being sent to him. And again, a webcam version of a guy engaging in masturbation. I want to encourage all of you to help the rest of us in protecting our children and supporting this bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Carroll. Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you so much for your testimony. I'm glad you're here, Mr. Gillespie, because I wanted to just explore an issue that hopefully you can help with in sort of a big picture way. One of the examples that Mr. Hargrove talked about was the kid who took the Hustler magazine to school and went on to be an offender. And I don't think that everybody who looks at a Hustler or goes on to take a Hustler to school goes on to be an offender. And I don't think any of us doubt the importance of this issue. And I tell you, as a parent, we really need to do something about this. And I'm extremely concerned about it. But what we're addressing with this bill and in general is prosecution, which hopefully will discourage others. And you help people who have already, you said, help them escape or get free. But how can we prevent, how can we make more of the people who might look at the Hustler but don't go on to be a sex offender? I don't think we're going to stop the information from being out there. But what is it that makes some people go down one road and other people go down another? And obviously we have a problem we have to deal with, but I don't know if we can legislatively do that, but just to understand the situation, we have a lot of problems, but how can we prevent them
rather
than address them after they've happened?
Thank you, Ms. Chair. I think part of it is not everybody's addicted to the same thing. There's a lot of addictions. You know, a lot of times you see someone's into pornography. For pornography to go to an extreme, usually it includes some sort of alcohol or drugs connected with that. And so when you put some of those together, you know, my specific thing happened to be addiction to me was pornography. It isn't alcohol. You know, I had that alcohol, but that wasn't the issue. But I think young boys in particular, because we are so visual. I mean, vision is what we see. Women are not designed that way. They don't look at a naked person and have the same effect that a young boy does. And so I think when you're dealing with young boys, of somehow being able to stop that stuff from coming, because once you get a hold of those things in your mind and you start working on them, they grow. And like any addiction, it's going to expand. And so, you know, how you stop it, I think, is there has to be some sort of way to say, look, we got to limit the accessibility of this stuff because it's so accessible now. And, you know, most children were not designed to deal with sexual things until they're older in life. So what's happening to them, it's actually robbing them of a childhood and introducing them to adult activities that they're not equipped to even think about. And so the whole Internet thing, the target of it, is the younger, the better. Because those are pure little boys and girls that know that they can take them. What predators look for are the vulnerable. And so some sort of way to make some teeth into that, that if they're going to do that, there's a penalty for that. It isn't just accessible without some sort of thing being there to say, hey, this is enough. Because, guys, this is a devastating thing. This is like, forget his name, what Bill Carroll shared, where this goes, where pornography goes, it has nothing to do with sex. It has to do with manipulation, control, abuse. I mean, the outcome of it is unbelievable when you get involved in those who go that path. It is devastating. And so those little kids don't know where this has taken them. And so they just get caught up into it because here's an adult saying, look, this is a good thing. And it's not. We need to take those adults that are saying that and say, look, this isn't a good thing. I don't know if that answered your
question.
Thank you.
In part. Thank you.
Okay. There are no further questions then. I'll excuse this panel. Next up, we have Kurt.
A visitor that was, I guess, that was invited from Senator Frank, Dr. Kurzoda. If you could call him.
I'm sorry, what's the name again?
Dr. Kurzoda.
Oh, yeah. In fact, I have the next on my list was Kurt Odo.
Okay, well, disregard that.
Very good. Well, he's doubly served.
Just give him again.
Hello, my name is Dr. Curtis Odo. I'm the medical director of the Jackson County Children's Advocacy Center. I'm a pediatrician who specializes in the evaluation of children that have been physically and sexually abused. I've been doing child abuse work since 1993 and have probably done over 2,000 child abuse evaluations since that time. I was the original person that went to Senator Kate Brown at the Oregon Law Commission to discuss specifically 2843. The reason why I'm here is there's a fear in my mind that people will avoid this bill because they'll see it as an anti-pornography bill. It is not an anti-pornography bill. It is an anti-grooming bill. The caveat of having the intentionally furnish puts it in the grooming bill. It eliminates the accidental exposure of children to pornography and someone being wrongly prosecuted for that. Clearly, sex offenders use pornography, specifically adult pornography, in grooming of children. I have the two articles that I use that I like to pass out, which is the use of pornography during the commission of sex offenses and how sex offenders lure children. The percentages of sex offenders using pornography in the grooming of children is 17% or higher in both of those studies. Clearly, we've heard already testimony where we have real-life cases where we are not able to prosecute sex offenders who are showing children adult pornography for the purposes of grooming. This is important legislation because this would actually be primary prevention of child abuse, meaning if someone was actually showing a child adult pornography and the child made a disclosure, we could actually intervene at a time when the child may not have been touched. And one of the very important things to keep in mind is by the time we catch an adult sex offender, they have already had on average 40 or more victims. So preventing one means we may prevent 40 or more victims. Some sex offenders have victims in the hundreds or thousands. So any chance that we have to intervene can prevent tragedy for all children in Oregon. And I don't want to belabor the point. You guys have already heard excellent testimony. I am well versed in the medical literature and all literature that I could possibly find in the exposure of children to pornography. So if there are any questions I could help with, I'd love to answer them.
Thank you, Dr. Odo, and thank you for coming a long way to present to us.
I can just sit at Barker. It seems to me a huge gateway to all this, too, is just regular, if not, programming as well as ads on TV. I mean, the only place that I can watch news and not hear about Britney Spears shaving herself or Anna Nicole Smith and on is on OPB. I mean, which I sent them a check in with that thought in mind just recently. But, I mean, all that crap that's just flooding out there. Right? And it would seem like to show a kid to say this is, you know, not that much more different.
Yeah.
It would appear that way to me.
I mean, clearly, sex abuse and physical abuse, but especially sex abuse, is a boundary issue. That's why pornography is used. It lowers the boundaries of children about what is right and wrong. I mean, we have the problem in our society with the things that you're mentioning, lowering boundaries. And actually, it is my belief that if we continue to lower boundaries, we're going to end up with more sex offenders. And it's part of our job, part of our job to our community and to our society to establish what those boundaries are and what type of behavior is acceptable. But in this case, it's really focused on grooming, meaning a sex offender approaching a child to later commit a sexual act.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much. Dr. Odo, you mentioned the term boundary issue. Can you describe for me what you mean by boundary?
Just the boundary between what is right and what is wrong, meaning a boundary issue could potentially be sexual harassment. Is it appropriate to touch someone's breast or genital region just in a school hallway or something like that? That's a boundary issue, meaning it's tolerated by a lot of people, but does that mean that it is right? And who establishes that boundaries? Well, actually, we're the ones that establish, the people in the community establish that that is not acceptable behavior. That's what I mean by boundary issue.
Falk, if I may, and then you said that the pornography actually is used to break down the boundary.
Right. A child being exposed to it doesn't have a sexual understanding and may be grossed out by the depiction of someone's genitals or something like that. But after repeated exposure, they may be more comfortable seeing a live person's genitals or seeing a sex act. So that instead of being grossed out, they become more desensitized and they're more likely to be a compliant victim.
One more, if I may.
Go ahead.
In your opening statement, you said that this is not an anti-pornography bill, but it's an anti-grooming bill. Based on what you just said, where is there any benefit for having pornography?
Where is there any benefit from having pornography for children? No.
For anybody.
Oh, for anybody? I'm really here to specifically address how it affects children.
Thank you.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Doctors, since you seem to be our best source for this that we've heard from today, is this a local, a U.S. problem? One of your articles is from Canada. Is it a Western European problem, too? And
yes, sir. Yes. There is no difference between the sex offenders in Canada or America or Western Europe. They have these patterns. They're very similar patterns.
Well, but I lived in Europe for some time, and I feel that they've always been more permissive. So are they seeing that's a problem too, and they're trying to address it in some way, like we're attempting to here?
It would be difficult for me to address the laws in Europe. They certainly have a very similar problem, but I don't know what their laws are.
Representative Forrest.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Odo, perhaps you have heard in the past few days and then in days and weeks prior, there were a couple of instances on the other side of the United States, one in Louisiana, one incident in Florida, regarding fifth graders who were engaged in sexual acts in front of their classroom when their teachers had left for 15, 20, 25 minutes. And I think that's probably a direct address to that we do have a significant societal problem, but it'll be interesting to see if there was any of the grooming element involved here, as we're obviously talking about hypersexuality and obvious some level of exploitation and even perhaps victimization as those children are acting out somewhere along the line. Do you have any thoughts about that?
Certainly we see that children that have been sexually abused when they're younger put themselves in a position to be victimized later on. It can become a recurrent pattern for them. I can't speak to any knowledge about those specific cases, but certainly a child that's been sexually abused when they're 4 or 5 later on put themselves in the position to be re-victimized when they're 12 or 13 or 14. And in a sense, you know, a public sexual act in a school is a type of victimization, meaning it's completely inappropriate and it's only going to lower their self-esteem and be harmful later on, stigmatizing. So, and yes, we see that from victims. I can't, there's no way to know if they've been exposed
obviously
to pornography.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Thank you, Dr. Odo.
Appreciate I did want to specifically address the exposure to pornography that Representative Bonamici said.
Please.
They've done studies on college students about exposing them to pornography, hardcore pornography. Specifically, there's three types of reactions. There's a reaction of disgust, which is a small percentage. There's a reaction of temporary arousal, but pretty minimal effect on them long term, meaning it doesn't change their sexual fantasy patterns. And there's a few of them where they may adapt the sexual fantasy pattern that they have based on what they've witnessed. And that's one of the reasons why it's very difficult to study pornography. Clearly, it doesn't change them into sex offenders. But what we need to be able to find in our studies is who becomes a sex offender, how do they become a sex offender, and I don't know that we know the answer to that. And like I said, most by the time a teenage male, by the age of 17, it's like 98% have been exposed to at least one episode of pornography somewhere along the line. For females, it's about 78%. Most of those don't go on to become sex offenders. As a matter of fact, the vast majority of them don't even continue to pursue pornography. So there's a reality. Is it dose-related? Is it what they're being exposed to? I mean, we have a little insight in that there was a study on juvenile sex offenders, and that the juvenile sex offenders that were viewing hardcore pornography had more victims than those that just used softcore pornography. That's really the only study that even directly addresses, you know, where on the continuum is a person who's exposing themselves to pornography. It becomes very difficult to study. We cannot show children pornography and then see what happens to them later on. So it becomes a difficult question. A lot of it is just retrospective, meaning an adult later telling us, this is the effect that it's had on me. But that is a very difficult way to study something like pornography.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for addressing that. And as a parent of teenagers, I'm not sure I wanted to hear all that. But I think it's my responsibility. But I think what I would really like to understand, in like I said, the big picture way, is if we can get to the what makes people put the pornography out there or have the need to do that or the urge to do that. It's just something I would like to understand in the larger context. If we could cut down on the number of people who are out there luring or grooming or manufacturing or selling whatever they do with porn or those desires, I think we'll be better off. I'm just not quite sure how we can address that, especially in our role as legislators. So,
and we've got several more witnesses to get to hear from. I'd like to conclude by 10:30 if I could. So unless there's something particularly we need to respond to in that comment, Dr. Odo, I mean, I would excuse you then. And we'll move forward to David Fedanke.
Do you want to bring up some other folks?
Sure. That'd be fine. If you,
I'm uncomfortable being all by myself.
That's fine. That's fine.
Lonely.
And we have other people on the list. Janet Webster from the Oregon Library Association.
Appropriate.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, David Fidanke, Executive Director, ACLU of Oregon. We were part of the work group on House Bill 2843 and gave our commitment to be neutral on the bill. But I need to modify that somewhat because of some communications we have had in the last couple of days with representatives of the Motion Picture Association and the Media Coalition. I believe Ted Hughes is here on behalf of the Motion Picture Association, and we'll be giving you a memo from the Media Coalition that was written by their executive director, David Horowitz, that raises substantial First Amendment concerns to House Bill 2843. And let me just say, and I'm going to try and keep this very short, but as the chair noted earlier, this is a very complicated area of the law. Oregon statutes dealing with furnishing obscene material to minors and which are generally in Chapter 167 of the ORS date back, most of them, to the criminal code reform in the early 70s that was carried out by the legislature, and some even earlier than that. There are some very quaint things in that chapter of the ORS, including a definition of obscenities that refers to terms that are not polite in mixed company. So to say that these laws need to be visited is probably the understatement of the decade. The work group was primarily concerned with trying to get at not so much the nature of the material, but what is done with the material and what the purpose of providing the material to a minor is. Where you see that in House Bill 2843 at its purest is in Section 3 of the bill, the luring section. There is consensus, I believe, on the part of all members of the work group that provision needs to be enacted. There is a provision in Oregon law that the Oregon Department of Justice still believes is constitutional, as it was revised, I think, in the 2003 session. However, as a practical matter, and that's the furnishing of obscene materials to minors law, which is one of the sections that would be repealed by House Bill 2843, the practical problem is that there isn't a DA in Oregon that is confident that law would be upheld on appeal, because there's parts of it that are clearly unconstitutional. And so the intent of the work group was to, by enacting Section 3 of House Bill 2843, to establish a clear, bright line that when someone is furnishing material that, and I'm looking at the bill now on page 2, with furnishes to a minor a visual representation or explicit verbal description of sexual conduct, which is relatively narrowly defined, and furnishes it for the purpose of inducing the minor to engage in sexual conduct or to arouse the person who is furnishing that material or to arouse the minor. That's clearly, we believe, can be prohibited. I don't think there's anyone involved in the work group who had any qualms about Section 3 of this bill. Some of us are much more nervous about Section 2. ACLU agreed to be neutral despite some of our concerns about the possible unconstitutionality of Section 2. It's much, much narrower than existing law and represents a major improvement over existing law. There is another provision of the bill that you're going to hear about, I think, from Mr. Hughes, which is Section 10 of the bill. And that's the current statute that prohibits sending, in current law, sending obscene material to minors. Now, this provision was added fairly late in the discussions of the work group. It wasn't subjected to the same kind of scrutiny as other parts of the bill. And at the time it was added, no one really thought about putting that through a First Amendment filter, First Amendment case law filter. And the Media Coalition has, I think, their major concerns are with Sections 2 and 10. And frankly, Mr. Chair, I think their concerns are well placed. So let me just sum up by saying that our position on House Bill 2843 is somewhat in flux at this point until we can complete a thorough analysis of the First Amendment case law that the Media Coalition has brought to our attention and that Mr. Hughes will be bringing to your attention. But if you wanted to be cautious in this area of the law, my recommendation to the committee would be to focus on Section 3 and perhaps recognize that Sections 2 and 10 either should be taken out of the bill or should be subjected to some more work. On House Bill 3515, we're not involved in the drafting of that. That is, the ACLU was not involved in the drafting of it. We did participate in a work group meeting last week, and we have no position on 3515 at this moment, Mr. Chair. But I did want to point out one issue that I think may have been a drafting error in the original bill. That is continued in the Dash 1 amendments. And it relates to the definition of a minor, which has two prongs. And currently, the way the bill is drafted, if one person, the person on the receiving end of an internet communication, for example, meets either prong of that test, the crime is committed by the person sending the message. And I would just like to ask the committee to consider one scenario in which that might not be appropriate, which is a scenario of two adults communicating with each other where they are engaging in role play, where one of the adults is pretending to be a minor, but both adults know that they are both adults. As I read the definition of a minor, that would still be a violation of the statute, because on line 20 of the Dash 1 amendments, just to pick one of them, the person is a minor if lines 19 through 21, if either a person receiving a communication represents himself or herself as being under 18 years of age, or the defendant reasonably believes the person is under the age of 18. I would argue that or should be an end. It should be both.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Fidanke. Let's hear from Janet Webster, and then we'll have an
Thank you, Chairman McPherson and members of the committee. I'm Janet Webster from Newport, Oregon, and I represent the Oregon Library Association. I chair their legislation committee. First, I'd like to thank Representative Olson and Senator Brown for including the Oregon Library Association in the working group. As Dave has mentioned and other panelists, this is a difficult issue, and the Library Association supports providing some kind of a tool to prosecute on the crime of grooming, as I believe we've been referring to it today. Yet we do have some concerns about First Amendment issues that are coming to light, I think, the more we talk about it. In Section 2 of this bill, there is an outright exemption for libraries for the crime of furnishing. This is something that is a holdover from the old law and is something that we support and was worked out in the working group. We need a point of clarification on that exemption. It includes school libraries, and we are concerned to make sure that schools include all academic libraries, which would be including our colleges and universities. The reason for this is that our universities, our public universities in particular, are open to anybody who wants to come in. A great example is the U of O Art Library that encourages middle school students to come in and use the collection. So if they use something that a parent might consider inappropriate in terms of that collection, we just want to make sure that they are covered with the exemption for furnishing. And we'd like to have that in the record. We also have some concerns about Section 10, the sending clause. In this case, libraries do not enjoy an exemption. And I guess an example here would be in my library, which is a university library, we have publicly accessible computers. So anybody could come in without a login and use those computers. And I have people from the neighboring marina that come in and do that because it's a fast internet connection. It would not preclude somebody from coming in with a memory stick that is loaded with files of sexually explicit material and sending them from that computer. So is that, what's the involvement of the library in the sending crime? I believe that we would be exempt or would have a positive defense. But again, that's a concern we have about sending that goes beyond probably, there's more specific than any of the First Amendment rights ones. From the library's perspective and the Library Association, we'd like some discussion of that, which has not happened at this point. So in general, I think that we support this as a tool. We have concerns about making sure that academic libraries are included in that exemption. And we have some concerns about Section 10 of sending. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you, Ms. Webster.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question for Mr. Fedanke. I thought in last night when I was reviewing these that I'd go look at the ACLU versus Gonzalez case that was very recent that addressed the Federal Child Online Protection Act, but when I realized it was 84 pages, I decided that I would ask you instead if there are overlapping provisions in that statute that are similar to or the same as 2843 that might be an issue.
Mr. Chair and Representative Bonamici, yes, I think there are those issues, and that is part of what the analysis we hadn't done. Because frankly, when we were meeting as a work group, we were focused primarily on who are the people we want to cover in this statute, how do we want to focus on it, and we were thinking about case law in Oregon, which is relatively sparse with regard to material being furnished to minors. And because the current statutes are so problematic, there's not a lot of clarity under Oregon case law. And frankly, I feel very foolish sitting here today without having consulted with our national office on some of these issues, particularly the internet communications issues, because the Gonzalez case is just one of the three cases, mm-hmm. the four cases that have gone to the U.S. Supreme Court relating to online transmission of material. And two of those federal laws have been tossed out in their entirety by the U.S. Supreme Court. And as I understand it, and it's been a while since I've read those decisions, but they were Reno versus ACLU and Ashcroft versus ACLU, and they are cited in the memo that Mr. Hughes will be giving you from the Media Coalition. As I understand the rationale in those cases, because there is no way for an internet service provider or a person, an organization maintaining a website to know who is accessing their website, who is using their internet services, and that there is no way to know one way or the other whether a person accessing the site is an adult or a minor, because even having a filter of requiring someone to have a credit card does not necessarily make that distinction, because minors, as I'm sure you know, Representative, can get access to credit cards. Sometimes it may require a parent co-signing to create the account. And under prior decisions of the U.S. Supreme Court, they have said that you can't prohibit access to material that adults have a right to have access to merely because minors may gain access to it. And in the SEPA case, which I think is the Gonzalez case that you were referring to, which is the Child Internet Protection Act that requires all libraries and schools which receive federal funds to have filtering software on their computers that are used by minors. Even in that case, the court said, in the case of a public library, for example, if an adult is using a computer that has filtering software, they interpreted the statute to require libraries to remove the filter if an adult requests it, because adults have the right to have access to all of that material. And the earlier cases, you know, there were medical sites that had discussions about how to avoid transmission of sexually transmitted diseases, for example. And that kind of material can't be barred even for minors, because they have an interest in making sure that they don't get STDs.
If I could break in here now,
yeah.
We're getting close to the end of our conclusion time.
I'm sorry that I went off on that, Mr. Chair, but under First Amendment case law, let me just sum up by saying this area is extremely complicated. We hadn't looked at those cases when we were involved in this work group on 2843. I think that needs to happen. So I'm glad that the committee is not moving either of these bills. And let me just make one final point. We would strongly caution, and I think ACLU would oppose merging these two bills before you this morning because of that complexity. I think it would be a big mistake to merge these two bills.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. Excuse these witnesses. We have three more people who have signed up, and I do want to get them on, and we'll continue just a little past 10:30, although those who have other commitments ought to feel free to leave. I'd like to go next to Ted Hughes, whose arrival has been forecast here by prior witnesses, but we're honored to have him with us.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I can't duck. I want to apologize to the committee and to the sponsors of the bills about these work sessions. I fancy myself as knowing what's going on in this building in the interim, and all the time I totally missed the work sessions. I was not invited. Maybe that was on purpose, because I couldn't be disruptive, you know. But I missed it totally, and had I been there and had I brought my organizations there, I probably wouldn't be here this morning, and I really apologize for that. My name is Ted Hughes, representing the Motion Picture Association of America, which are the producers and distributors of motion pictures in the United States, and the Entertainment Software Association. These are the folks that produce the 90% of the videos for the gaming industry. Both of them have concerns. Both of them spend their 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, in areas such as House Bill 2843, making sure that the bills that are drafted and are passed are constitutional. I told your staff I have not handed out the memo from the Motion Picture Association or the Entertainment Software Association, or for that matter the other one. I will make copies of them and get them to you. I did not, because these organizations were going to come here personally and testify before you, but it fell apart. Their travel plans fell apart. I was hoping, and I'd like to plead with you that you set another hearing. And I suggested the 18th, Mr. Chairman. I don't know what your schedule looks like, but they are available and would be happy to come here at that time and testify. And in conclusion, I'd like to read the conclusion of one of their testimonies so you can see the level of their involvement. It says, we urge the members of the Oregon Legislature to amend existing Oregon law to bring it into compliance with the standards established by the U.S. Supreme Court in Ginsburg. We believe that a constitutionally correct statute will enable prosecutors to bring charges against those who furnish matter that is harmful to the minors, confident that an appeals court will not overturn their prosecution. As currently drafted, prosecutors may hesitate before they file a case due to the likelihood that a conviction would be overturned. And it would be my hope that they could discuss that with you on the 18th or whenever your schedule permits it. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Hughes. And we will be looking at their calendar to see whether that could work for getting further input. Are there any questions for Mr. Hughes at this point, given that his the people he's representing aren't here to respond?
No, just a quick comment, Mr. Chair, if I may. I think we all appreciate the need to address this issue and the seriousness of it, but I want to make sure that what we're doing is something that's going to be enforceable. And so in light of that, I think it's important to hear from that industry and make sure that we're crafting something that will be upheld rather than overturned.
Right. I think that's sound view. Thank you, Mr. Hughes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Our last two witnesses are Amy Miller and Amy Alconich. Well, we'll be here briefly, and then we can hear today, and then if we do continue to another hearing, there'll be an opportunity for others to respond at that point.
Good afternoon, Chair McPherson. I guess it's still the morning. Good morning, Chair McPherson, members of the committee. Amy Alconich here on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, and I'm here solely on 3515 to voice my support for this bill with some changes that I think some are drafting errors and some are some things that we overlooked during the work group on this bill. And I would like to add, I know I only have a short period of time, and I'll try and be as brief as possible, but if there is another hearing, and I'd love an opportunity to further expand if I don't get to finish today.
Excuse me, and Ms. Alconich, is that those comments on 2843 or on 3515 or both?
I am only here on 3515.
I see. Okay.
The first thing I'd like to say is that we did get together with the Department of Justice, with Counsel Stanford, with the DA's Association, with the Juvenile Rights Project. Representative Krieger was present. Mara Gross from Kate Brown's office was present. And we all sat down and looked at 3515 and said, how can we make this as close to constitutional as possible? And I think we've come pretty close. And the way I think we've done that is that we've excluded some of the issues that 2843 may have as far as the furnishing of explicit materials. The goal of sitting down on this bill was to say what kind of conduct is not currently covered in the criminal statute and what should be covered. What are prosecutors trying to get at that they can't currently get out now? And the place where we arrived, at least on Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers' position, is that we want to protect kids who are being solicited online to actually get together and engage in sexual conduct with an adult. So we didn't want to just say sending, you know, pictures of somebody masturbating over the internet should be illegal. We didn't want, at least Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, did not want to take it to that step. One, because we think it's potentially unconstitutional, and two, because we are not in favor of creating per se crimes, and we believe that that's what that would do. So I think the place we've arrived on 3515, both in Section 1 and Section 2, is that Section 1 addresses the people who actually make an attempt to get together. When I say attempt, I don't mean showing up at the door. What I mean is in the course of the online conversation saying, well, can't we get together? Can I meet you at your parents' house? Can I meet you at the school? And that's that conduct right before somebody actually gets together with the individual. And I think everyone agreed that that's where the online behavior becomes significantly or potentially more dangerous, that takes it the additional step beyond fantasy, beyond role-playing, beyond just pornographic exchanges. And the second section is when somebody actually shows up at the door. And while I agree that can be prosecuted already, it seemed to be an important component of this bill that they went hand in hand. I think some of the errors are that, and I checked with Department of Justice in Section 3, Big A, that it's not supposed to be 18 years of age, it's supposed to be 16 years of age. So under 16, not under 18. The purpose for that is to make sure that we don't capture the 17-year-old and the 15-year-old. I guess you couldn't with this, but the 18-year-old and the 17-year-old. And so I think that needs to be changed, and I think everyone would agree that was not how it was intended to be drafted. And the second issue is in Section 3 as well, and Mr. Fedenke talked about this issue. I think the or should be an and. And I'm sure that most members of the work group would agree with that, although I haven't checked with them. The third place that I didn't even think of when we were sitting down and looking at this is also in Section 3, little e, which is line 8. It's the definition of solicit, and it's defined as means to seduce, lure, entice, persuade, prevail upon, coax, coerce, or attempt to do so. I think this creates essentially a double attempt. So I think I would recommend getting rid of or attempts to do so, because you would be attempting to attempt something. And that seems kind of foolish and silly a little bit. So those are, in 2 minutes or less, our problems with the way this is drafted. And again, I think this is pretty close to a good bill as a standalone bill and addresses some of the issues that people have concerns about without going too far. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Elkonich.
Chair McPherson and members of the committee, my name is Amy Miller. I'm a staff attorney at the Juvenile Rights Project, and I've submitted a written testimony to you, so I'm just going to cover a couple key points briefly, and I appreciate you guys giving me a couple of minutes at the end of the hearing. First, I want to mention that we support the concepts contained in I'm only here on 2843. We support the concepts contained in this bill, which are targeted at preventing people from providing these types of materials to children and grooming and luring them. We are not involved in the original work group, but commend the sponsors for their commitment to protecting children. We have a couple of concerns about Section 2, which I wanted to raise briefly. Basically, it prohibits the showing of sexually explicit materials to youth under age 13, and this is pretty broad and encompasses some normal juvenile behavior. For example, if a 17-year-old shows this type of material to her 12-year-old brother, the 17-year-old would be guilty of this offense. I did some research and found out that it's pretty normal for adolescents to be curious about these types of images and to seek them out and talk about and look at these images with their friends. And just to be clear, these images, this definition of sexually explicit material, Section 1, Sub 5, it's not just hardcore pornography type stuff. It's sexual intercourse, human masturbation. So it's not some things that we think of as extremely explicit. In our experience, these types of materials are readily available in the home, and you've heard that today quite a bit. Punishing a juvenile for showing these types of materials to his younger brother, especially when they're so easily accessible, doesn't seem to make sense. And we believe this type of circumstance is more of a family issue and should be handled by parents. Research also indicates that there are vast differences between juvenile and adult sex offenders. The brains of adolescents are in the development phase. As a result, adolescents are subject to short-sighted decision-making, failure to consider and understand consequences, poor impulse control, and vulnerability to peer pressure. There's little evidence to suggest that juvenile sex offenders go on to become adult sex offenders because they don't have the normal deviant-type mentality. It's more likely that their behavior is motivated by normal adolescent curiosity. And because of these concerns, we support amending 2843 in the same way as 3515 so that it doesn't include juvenile defendants. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Cameron.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Miller, is 35, maybe this is a question for our previous testimony, has 3515 been run past the motion picture industry and the First Amendment test?
Representative Cameron, I'd love to answer that question for you, but I do not think I'm able to.
Representative Cameron, Chair McPherson, if I could respond, I'm not, and actually maybe the most picture organization could respond.
Let's talk about the representative for that industry.
This is Ted Hughes, representing the Motion Picture Association and the Entertainment Software Association. They have not given me any comments or positions on that, on 35, what is it?
3515.
My comments were strictly 2843.
Mr. Chair, I wouldn't want to go 6 months down the road like we have on the last bill and not have somebody show up to tell us what's going on with that. So maybe there's some more information there.
Mr. Chair, if I could just answer Representative Cameron's question. I don't know about the Motion Picture Association, but I did send a link to House Bill 3515 to David Horowitz of the Media Coalition yesterday, and he's reviewing it currently. So I'm sure by the time these bills come back, we'll have some comment from him on it.
Thank you. Unless there are questions of these witnesses, I think there's some more work that needs to be done and focus on these issues. So I appreciate everybody's attention to them today. I'll close the public hearing on House Bills 2843 and House Bill 3515. That concludes our agenda. We're adjourned.